Had to say that for Shannon. So today everything's the same and everything's different. Usually there's a face right here and she's not here today. But she's still looking down on us. And I want to just dedicate this message to Jolene. So this is the second of my two messages, and it's about freeways. It's about expressways. It's about highways, and it's about the Christian walk. So last 3 weeks ago, I talked about the Jerusalem-Gaza Expressway and the fact that there was a man of God who listened to God's voice and went on an extraordinary journey to do extraordinary things that he had no idea what they were going to be. This week, and oddly enough, if you take a look at your Bibles, it is the story that follows immediately hot on the heels without any break from the story about Philip. It's another story about a traveler. This traveler is quite a bit different than the other traveler, but oddly enough, we're going to walk through this passage, and I'm going to suggest to you that the same extraordinary results happen to men and women of God. So everything's the same, and everything's different. So maybe you haven't persecuted anybody lately, but fasten your seatbelts, and we're going to take a look at somebody who did. Before we start, just a word of prayer that this is going to touch somebody's heart today, and they're going to be moved to change the way they do business with God. Heavenly Father, please descend upon us. You're here in this building through this worship. Please be with us as we listen to your word from Scripture. Amen. So I am just absolutely thrilled with the summer series. I don't know about you guys, but I love traveling, and I love to hear travel stories, and I read travel logs, and so these are the stories that we've heard this summer. This is the 9th one in our series of 10, and Ted made an unabashed publicity for his sermon next week, and I'm going to do it again. So the 10th one is not to be missed. I just called it The Last Journey, and actually I wrote this before I knew you were actually going to be doing it. And it still fits very, very amazingly. The last journey, the first journey at the end of 10, we're going to have traveled pretty well this summer. So what is this? I'm going to do a little bit of compare and contrast with my message from 3 weeks ago with Philip and the Ethiopian, because there are some interesting parallels, even though it seems like they're so different, these stories. Well, they're still on highways, and there is some work, God at work, in both stories. We're going to see if we can draw any closer parallels, but I think there's some really interesting things going on with this whole story. So instead of going to Gaza, going west about 70 kilometers, we're actually going to go northwest about, well, as the crow flies, about 220 kilometers. If you take the roads, it's about 350 kilometers, and if you avoid all the checkpoints for military, it's about 4,000 kilometers. Depending. So, it happened, Damascus. Who was Saul? Or was it Paul? Well, anyway, we're going to look into that and see what a difference a name can make. When was it? It was around 33 to 36 AD. So, that's a few years, but not very many years after the crucifixion. Historians believe it was between 3 and 5 years after the crucifixion. That's significant. Where was it? It was on this road that I was telling you about. And I think the big what that I want you to take away from today is there's a difference in the life of a Christian between doing and being. And we often in 21st century have a hard time with the second, and we're really focused on the doing. So I'm going to encourage you today to take a few minutes to think about that distinction, and then I'm going to suggest how and why it matters. So what? All right? So if there was ever someone in the Bible who fits into the category of summer traveler, it was Paul. And you heard last week from Wes when Paul was giving his sermon on Mars Hill in Athens. So Paul did a lot of traveling. He was born over here on the right side in this little town of Tarsus. Turns out it wasn't a little town. It was a major commercial center, one of the most important places for trade in all of the Mediterranean at the time that he was born. Then he had a bit of experience. We're going to go through this. Wasn't good enough to stay in his hometown. Like everybody else, he wanted to go see the big city. And so where did he go? He went to Jerusalem. And he went to one of the best universities. Well, it wasn't really a university. It was a rabbinical school. And studied under one of the best rabbis of the time down in Jerusalem. And got straight A's. He got so straight A's that he was catapulted into a category of rabbi in training to do some special work to root out some heresies. We're going to come to that. But after that, he had an unexpected experience, which is the subject of our story today. On the road to Damascus, something happened, changed his life. He went then to Arabia for a few years, came back, and then started his frequent flyer program. And he went on three missionary journeys. One of them was sort of up into Asia Minor. One was a little bit further, and the third one was even further, and he ended up not really on a missionary journey, but he got sent to prison and ended up in Rome and died in Rome, and so that was the end of his frequent flyer program. But just to say, if there was anybody who fits into our summer series about traveling, it would be Paul. We're only going to focus today on the little thing that happened on the road to Damascus. So I thought it might be interesting to start with an experience that happened to me this week. And so this week, last week, I was in France, I was cycling, and I was super pumped about the whole experience. As you can imagine, you know, France, fine food, fine drink, all this kind of beautiful scenery. And I was just pumped and I was thinking about it. This is the kind of scenery I expected to see. This is the kind of thing I expected to do. And I traveled to the south of France. It's a bit of a complicated story, but I always like to say I have property in France, which is a bicycle. So anyway, I had to go down to the south of France to pick up my bicycle because I was going to go cycling on the east side of France, a place called Alsace. And so I got my bicycle and I stayed with the family that was keeping my bicycle and we had a great time and said my goodbyes and I got my bicycle and I rolled it down to the train station and I had a first class ticket to go on a TGV from the south of France to the east of France and it was 10 o'clock departure and I was there at 10:10 and I had my bicycle and the conductor said, "Monsieur, vous ne montez pas avec un vélo." And that roughly translates into no bikes on the train. So I thought, this is going to be interesting. My devious side said, "Who's looking?" And then everybody was. So it was a double-decker TGV. There was absolutely no room for baggage. And so I said, this is a moment that I had not anticipated. I always thought that I could fix things if I just took a little bit of time. And the idea that a conductor would say, "Monsieur, there are no bicycles on the train," meant not that there were not bicycles on the train, but never could they be bicycles on the train when they had their wheels on. He said, "If you want to take the wheels off, take it apart, you can do that." And I said, "I don't think that's going to work in 10 minutes. He said, "I don't think so either." So the upshot of this story is that sometimes the most important part of traveling is waiting. So I saw the train leave. I wasn't on it. My bicycle was with me. And I thought, so now what? So what I did was I made some inquiries. And sure enough, I don't know if the train company and the sports companies are in cahoots, but the train company made a couple quick calls. They said, "Oh, you can go over there, spend $120 and buy a bag for your bicycle. And you can catch the next train, which is at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock or whatever." So I thought, well, that sounds like a plan. But the essence of the story is that when I was forced to realign, reassess my priorities and my possibilities, I started thinking about the adventure of traveling differently than just doing the traveling. So I had a journal, I sat down my journal, I said, you know, one of the most important things about traveling is learning to wait and learning that there might be some other plan that I have to listen to. This is what happened to Paul on a theological level. Now, he didn't have a bicycle, and it was a little bit more dramatic than simply someone saying, you can't take your bike on the train. But it was the same kind of attitude adjustment, forced by an unexpected circumstance that catapulted him into a new way of seeing how he was going to be traveling, how he was going to be doing his work. So, let's dive into the message. The message is Acts chapter 9, 1 to 9. And I've highlighted a few words here because, to me, they are the ones that really get at the message of the difference between traveling and waiting, or doing and being. So the first word, meanwhile. Meanwhile. So that means that there's kind of doing going on at two different places. So we just finished chapter 8. Chapter 8 said Philip was approached, had a thought from an angel that said, go down to the road on the way to Gaza. And he did, and he went down there, and that's what we saw 3 weeks ago. He had this amazing experience with an Ethiopian, and the Ethiopian said, I need your help to understand this. And so Philip helped him, and then Philip baptized him, and then Philip disappeared. That's quite an amazing story. But meanwhile, something else was happening. So what else was happening? Saul was still breathing out murderous threats against the Lord's disciples. He went to the high priest, and he asked him for letters to the synagogues in Damascus, so that if he found any there who belonged to the way, whether men or women, he might take them as prisoners to Jerusalem. As he neared Damascus on his journey, suddenly a light from heaven flashed around him. Doing, 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 going to the rabbis, getting on his horse, starting a journey, taking them as prisoners. He had it all planned out, and it was all on his to-do list. He fell to the ground and heard a voice say to him, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? Who are you, Lord? Saul asked. I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting, he replied. Now get up and go to the city, and you will be told what you must do. So here we have a very stark change in the whole doing and being play. We have suddenly Saul facing the conductor on the train who says, no bicycles. He says, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? Who are you, Lord? I am Jesus. And then Jesus says, you want a to-do list? I'll give you a to-do list. You go into the city, and there you will be told what you must do. So the last bit of the passage we're going to look at today is the last three verses. The men traveling with Saul stood there speechless. They heard the sound, but they did not see anyone. Saul got up from the ground, but when he opened his eyes, he could see nothing. So they led him by hand into Damascus. For 3 days he was blind and did not eat or drink anything. He waited. He waited. He waited. And for a doer, and I know there are some of you in this church family that are doers, the hardest thing to do is to wait. Bruce Coburn said, the trouble with patience is it takes such a long time. So maybe God is sort of speaking to you this morning about being, waiting, rather than doing. You know, if you take a look at 1 Corinthians 13, all those characteristics of love, They're about being. Being kind, being gentle. They're not about doing. They're about being. So let's unpack this passage just a little bit more to see what we have. Now, this is partly in honor of Jolene, but the reason I love Jolene so much, there's just so many reasons, like all of us here. But one of the reasons is she and I shared a common teaching style. We love maps. We love dressing up and giving, you know, kind of visual effects to the messages that we give. So a couple of maps here of the road to Damascus. Now, I said to you it's between 220 and 360 kilometers. That's quite a range. But because of the physical unrest, because of the social unrest, political unrest, and because of the geography, it can be different distances. If you take an airplane and fly from Jerusalem to Damascus, it's only 220 kilometers. But if you take the most direct land route, it is through the Mount of Olives, from the Mount of Olives up through Galilee, and then past the Sea of Galilee, looking on the left map, and then up through the highlands of the Golan Heights up to Damascus. So that's kind of the best walking or horseback riding route. Today, if you take a look over here, well, I don't know how you get to Damascus. Maybe, as they say in some parts of Canada, you can't get there from here. Because Damascus is a pretty unhappy place right now. But there we have the modern map on the right. So it wasn't an insignificant trip that Paul had to make. But Paul was pretty determined, and he knew what he was doing. He wanted to go and persecute. He wanted to collect up that new heresy. Now, it's interesting, if you think of this for a minute, if this just happened 3 years after the crucifixion, it's amazing that that was already such a force that the synagogue, the rabbis, the Pharisees, had already decided that this was something that was worthwhile their time and money. So interesting, the message of Jesus is so contagious that after just 3 years, it was already a concern to the Jewish authorities. But then we go back to this whole notion of doing and being. And so I want to take us now from, it's often that we are in the 21st century, we think it's always been that we're the first generation to be really busy. Doesn't seem like that's the case, because the doing of Paul is contrasted with this photo on the right, which is a painting that was done by a 16th century Italian, where it shows Paul being. And the reason it shows him being is it's not riding on a fast horse anymore. The horse is still there, but Paul is on his back. Paul is forced into a position of being. And if any of you have dogs, whenever a dog decides he wants to kind of not be aggressive and kind of give up, he rolls over on his back and goes like this. That's the posture that Paul has. And Paul understands that he's beat. He's beat in this situation. He has run into something he's never run into before, and he's in total submission. He's in total being mode, not by choice necessarily. So, another representation of this whole event, the conversion of Paul. This is, my favorite artist of all time, Peter Bruegel, a Flemish guy. And if you can see a little tiny speck in the very center of the painting, that's Paul again on his back. So there's this universal. Can you see right in the center? Take the butt of the horse. I guess that's the easiest thing to see. And then just go a little bit left and a little up, and there's a little bluish grayish dot. That's Paul. Okay, he's on his back, and he's in total submission. Now the interesting thing about these depictions is that everyone seems to have the same notion of what this would have done to Paul. It would have, as we say, knocked him on his butt. It would have put him in a completely submissive position. He was no longer in control, even if he did have his papers from the rabbi. So about this Paul guy, why is this even important? Well, this is important because Paul is one of perhaps the most effective voices of Christ in the new era. And so this guy that had all of these plans to do harm is actually doing good. And there's verse in the Bible that Joseph from Egyptian times said, you know, my brothers, you did this to do harm to me, and it came to good. And so Jesus is playing this out with Paul and saying, you know, you came to do harm for me, to my name, to my people, to persecute me, and I'm going to turn this into good. So how does he turn this into good? And I'm always amazed by all the pieces that God puts into place so that people become effective in ministry. So Paul was raised, as I said, in Tarsus. Now, Tarsus is a very interesting town because it's in the middle of Turkey now, today, but in the old days it would have been in Galatia, what we call Galatia or Asia Minor. And because there had been a Roman general who was from there and was rewarded by the emperor with a certain privilege, anybody who lived in that town was given Roman citizenship. Even though the father of Paul was an Israelite. Well, he was Jewish. But the thing is, he had dual citizenship, and he gave that to his son because they came from the city of Tarsus. And so that's going to become significant because he's from Tarsus. Just a little bit of linguistic background here. He's speaking Greek as a kid, but probably at home he spoke Hebrew and maybe a little Aramaic. And because the city was inundated with Romans, he probably spoke Latin too. So the kid grows up speaking four languages. This is going to become important. Then he decides to go to university in Jerusalem. And so when he's 15 or 10 or who knows, 20 maybe, he goes down to Jerusalem and is schooled by the rabbinical teachers. So he becomes schooled in classic Hebrew theology. He is a Pharisee of Pharisees. He says he is, and he's from the tribe of Benjamin. And then the last part of his journey is he becomes a convert and a missionary. But what about this name thing I promised to explore? Many people think that on the day that he had this conversion experience, Jesus said to him, you know, you're a different man. Jesus didn't say anything like that. He called him Saul. Saul, why do you persecute me? And so in fact, to just demystify the Saul-Paul problem, is that Paul had two names. His Jewish name, his Hebrew name, was Saul. And it was a very royal name because he was from the tribe of Benjamin, and also King Saul was from the tribe of Benjamin. And so it was a name that said, he who is demanded, he who is important, he who is asked for. But he also had a Roman name, and the Roman name was Paul. And the Roman name, quite ironically, means little, humble. And again, you sort of think, not really an accident. Because if you read through Paul's letters, he said, I'm the least of these, I'm humbled. And he really picked up that namesake. So he was, to the Jews, Jewish. To the Gentiles, Gentile. And he was Saul. And he was Paul. He was asked for, he was important, and he was small. So not really a divine name change, but God orchestrating the dual name with a certain irony so that he would be able to do his ministry. So what became of him? We know this. He became one of the most important proponents of the new way. He's credited, as you probably know, with writing many, many, many of the books of the New Testament, about somewhere between 7 and 14 of the 27 books of the New Testament. He was a powerful speaker. You heard from Wes last week about his speech to the Athenians. And he had all of this background. He had these languages. He could speak in Latin. He could speak in Greek. He could speak in Aramaic. He could speak in Hebrew, and he used that to his advantage, preaching. So the missionary journeys went from his hometown in Tarsus to where the Christians were first identified in Antioch, all the way to Rome and the Roman guards. He used his languages to talk to kings, to talk to common people, to talk to people who were looking for knowing Christ. But what was it about Saul's conversion experience that is relevant to us? Well, I think there's some really interesting things going on with him. It was totally unexpected. And I think you know, and you might be one of these people, who had a totally unexpected conversion experience. You were walking one direction, and something happened in your life, and you knew God was approaching you. He put you off your horse. He stopped you from putting your bicycle on the train, and he said, "You are going to be one of mine." That could have happened. That happened to a headstrong Paul. So Saul was on one mission, Jesus was on another. Are you on a mission, and Jesus calling you to another? Totally unsolicited. Not only was it unexpected, I don't think Saul was ready to have that experience that day. He had things to do. This really messed up his to-do list. Okay? It was unexpected, and it was unsolicited. In fact, the only thing Saul knew, and this, I think, is somewhat ironic, fascinating, that he recognized the voice as Lord. Don't you find that weird? Could have been anything. Could have been thunder. Could have been something that happened. But he said, "Lord, who are you?" It was totally overwhelming. So not only was it unexpected, unsolicited, but it was overwhelming. And here we have another painting from the 16th century. Saul is alone on his back. His entourage, his handlers, they didn't hear it. They heard something, but they didn't. So the only person there, there's a one-to-one conversation between Jesus and Paul. So he's alone on his back. He loses his physical senses. He goes blind. He fasts. And Jesus pushes his reset button. And he says, "You know what? I think you should stop. I think you should listen. And worst of all, I think you should wait." Not exactly in Paul's vocabulary. And then finally, it's totally transformative. Saul adjusts his priorities. Now, why is this unbelievable, incredible, fabulous? It's because Saul was a man of action. He was an intellectual. He was a theologian. And Jesus says, "This is going to be totally emotional. I don't really care what you think theologically. You've just had an experience. And that experience is so overwhelming that you cannot deny that you have to change your ways." And sometimes God will approach us in the areas, in the means, in the avenues that are least comfortable, least likely. Like, you know, I'm a person who likes books, and he's going to say, "No, I'm going to put this in your heart." Or, you know, you're somebody who's emotive, and somebody hands you a book and says, "You should read this," and you read this, and your life is transformed. God likes to just catch you on a bit of an angle, on a bit of a perspective to change. So I said I was going to give you an opportunity to see some of the contrast between the freeway to Gaza and the freeway to Damascus. So Paul, I said before, or sorry, Philip, he got an active call from an angel. He responded to that, went on the road. He had an unexpected encounter with the eunuch from Ethiopia. He said, "You know what you're reading?" And the Ethiopian said, "How can I unless it's explained to me?" Philip explained it to him and said, "You know, anything else?" And the Ethiopian said, "Why wouldn't I be baptized?" So Philip baptized, and we had a seized opportunity to bring someone into the family of the Lord. So a little bit different on this side. Instead of an active call, from the Lord. We had an active agenda from a person. Paul, I'm going to do this. This is what I think is the right thing to do, and I'm going to go do it. And he had a driven agenda to achieve that plan. But here is where the two stories start to converge. There was an unexpected encounter, and that was Jesus saying, boom, why are you persecuting me, Saul? Knocks him off his horse. And with that encounter, there's a call from Jesus to change, to be changed. And guess what? We end up in the exact same place. Everything's different and everything's the same. Because Paul seizes the opportunity and becomes the missionary, the traveler extraordinaire in all of the Old Testament or in the New Testament. So interestingly, different processes, similar result. So what? What's the relevance today, 2017? I guess this is where I say we have some homework to do. Are you working from your agenda, or are you working from God's agenda? Sometimes you need to have your bike stopped, not let on the train, so that you have an opportunity to reflect and to think about who you are, what you're doing, why you're doing it, creating a to-be list. And I think the big key to that reflection is praying. I say, no prayer, no way. If you don't understand what God's asking you to do, maybe that's because I haven't talked to him enough. If I have a good friend and I don't talk to him for a few years, I forget what he's up to. And so prayer is the key to discerning God's agenda. And the next speaking series is all going to be about prayer. So maybe we can file our pencils so we can take some notes on prayer. And then I think the really exciting thing about being a Christian, although if you're really organized, this might be slightly scary, but if you're not, it's always fun. Expect the unexpected, because God's always had a plan for your life. If you look at 1 Jeremiah 5, or Jeremiah 1, 5, you'll see God's prediction, or God's saying to Jeremiah was, before I formed you in the womb, I know you. I knew you. Before you were born, I set you apart, and I appointed you as a prophet to all nations. And that's the promise that he has for us. And that unexpected seems impossible for us now, but when it happens, you'll say, wow, he really did have a plan, and that plan is good. This is an interesting one. I think from this story, it's pretty obvious that sometimes God does hit your reset button. And you can do it by choice, or sometimes God will do it by shock. So don't be surprised by that. Seize the opportunity. And that's the common story, the ending for both stories on the road to Damascus and the road to Gaza. So we should be able to take encouragement from that sharing the gospel might not be that scary. We just had an interesting experience last night. There's a very strong Christian academic at the University of British Columbia Law School who was somewhat covering his faith. And last night on a blog, he said, I'm coming out. I'm a Christian and I'm a law professor in a secular university. And that was kind of weird, kind of wild. That just doesn't happen because his career now is kind of on the line. And the idea that he could say that and evangelize from that position is something that we might think about. The other thing, as in the last message, you may have to repeat this a couple times. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Start with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Start with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Because discerning God's will is an ongoing process. And quite honestly, the rewards are eternal. The rewards are daily. And this is where I want to end with a tribute to Jolene. Jolene has affected us all. She showed us how we could have joy in the journey. And now she's in eternity. And that's because of the choices she made. And that's of the because of the way she lived her life, and that's because of everything she did to affect our life. So I want to just leave this song with us as we think about Jolene and we think about our church family here at Pine Grove. Paul?
Freedom for those who